In the world today, mental health is an issue which thankfully more and more people are becoming aware of and comfortable speaking about. When choosing a professional to help you, what kind of service would you be looking for? At Lonvara, when asked to describe Mel Purcell's service, clients described it as real, compassionate, empowering, friendly, welcoming, inner strength building, a positive, safe, supportive environment, and she was described by one source as an absolute legend who enables change with love. Mel offers clinical counselling, hypnotherapy, and a professional service which is tailored to the individual. She has a personal approach and makes sure each client's experience is authentic to their needs while also ensuring full confidentiality. Winner of the 2022 Australian Allied Health Awards for Rural and Remote Excellence, you can self-refer or through your GP mental health care plan. Lonvara, believing in you. This week, former Devonport boy, now living in Melbourne and mixing with some of the country's elite sports people and newsbreakers, Ayrton Woolley. Lots will know Ayrton from his journalistic work with Channel 9 and now as co-host of the hugely popular The Truth Hurts podcast with none other than the king himself, Wayne Carey. Ayrton takes us through his journey into journalism, including how a chance meeting with Tony Jones set him on a path to fulfilling his goals. He talks about the unbelievable work ethic you have to have in news to make the cut, the pressures and struggles journos have, particularly in this modern 24/7 news world of social media. He gives great insight into managing different personalities, egos, and how relationship building is so important in his game. Lastly, we talk about how his relationship with the man known to many as the greatest AFL player ever came about, and how a country kid from northwest Tassie has managed to find himself not only working on their highly rating podcast, but also being a trusted ally who's not afraid to give a bit back to the king. This is a journey of persistence, standing your ground, putting yourself in the right positions while also staying true to your values and morals.
Taco! I was like, of course I'm not going to walk again. Like, that's just the reality, isn't it?
And the doctor that rang Mum said, oh, we've saved your son's life.
And I remember looking up and just saying, that wasn't out. And he looked at me and he said, no, it wasn't. But I didn't want to give you not out because you're my son. And I said, fuck me, Dad.
I just remember her telling us, your daughter's got leukemia.
You're in school. Oh, we swapped class a couple of times.
Who's cluier out of the two of you?
Both got the same smartness. Not real smart at all.
If you are dedicated to something, as long as it's safe and it's not hurting anyone else, I don't think anything should hold you back.
Keep pushing forward, you know. Days get tough sometimes. You know, it does turn around. You just gotta fight for it a little bit.
I was like, why can't we be that 1% that survived? She said to me then, she goes, you were more like me than I ever realised.
The Talk Art Podcast with Brendan Hinkson.
Ayrton Woolley, welcome to the Talk Art Podcast.
G'day, Brendan. Good to talk to you.
Absolutely, mate. Great to have you on. A lot of people will know you from your work with Channel 9 and recently with the Juggernaut Truth Hurts podcast, because I know a lot of people have jumped on board that. But it was only through listening to that, which I'm an avid listener to it. I love it and I love the duck. But it came out in there that you're from Devonport. I think you were talking about your toughest footballers and you named the Weed, who played just down the road here from where I live. But I thought, shit, I better get this bloke on because, you know, again, it's another good story, another good example of what people from this area can do.
Yeah, certainly a proud Tasmanian. I never shy away from that when it comes up in conversation with different people. We've had sort of a varying newsroom where I've spent the bulk of my career, people from all over the place, South Australians, Victorians and, you know, Queenslanders and so on. But you always cop a bit as a Tasmanian, but I reckon it's a bit of a badge of honour too. And I find when you meet up with Tassie people, wherever, you might not even know who they are, but you have this automatic sort of bond with them when you meet up in the state. So, definitely try and get back when I can. My folks are still there. I've got a lot of mates on the coast. So,
like I said, I think it's a good story, and we'll touch on your own footy career, because I think it's a good thing that a bloke that was dominating for East Devonport managed to, you know, be rubbing shoulders with probably the greatest footballer ever and doing a podcast with him. But it's a funny one. I was just thinking there before, I think you're the first person that I've ever got on the podcast who makes a living out of interviewing other people. So that's a bit unnerving for me, but I'll have to bring my A-game.
Well, I must admit, mate, just coming on, it is a bit different. And I've found it this year talking about myself. Like, obviously, the Truth Hurts is you know, mainly about Wayne Carey. But, you know, more and more I'm sort of, you know, playing my part in it. So, yeah, even doing this now, it's a bit funny because normally you're on the other side of the microphone.
Yeah, I was going to ask you whether or not you'd been interviewed before, but it's one of those things we sort of interview other people. It's, you know, all the pressure's on them. We don't have to give that much of ourselves. It's a bit unnerving, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so, mate. I think so. I've definitely thought about today after I got your call to say, say we were doing it today. I thought, geez, I better get organised here. Can't disgrace myself. So
this one will smash it out of the park, mate, I'm sure. oh, yeah, we've got you at a good time, though, because you're having a bit of a gap year. Like, apart from the podcast, things are, you know, sort of pretty quiet on the work front at the moment for you, sir.
Yeah, so I made a decision. I probably made it last year, but I stayed on for a few more months with Channel 9 that I wanted to change. So I've been there for 13 years and enjoyed it for the most, you know, enjoyed it for the most part and extremely grateful for everything I got to do there. But I knew I needed a change.
Yep.
And it sort of coincided with my partner and I having our first child. So we've got little Ayla. He's 8 months old now.
Yep.
So, yeah, I knew I needed a break, you know, a whole lot of different, you know, every job's got pressures. This one with some unique ones, I guess. And
yep.
I'm just keen to find something new to sort of stimulate me and get me going, get me out of bed every day.
Yeah, awesome. And we'll unpack that as it goes along because, you know, I'm fascinated to know the sort of pressures that that you guys in the media do have. And it's one of those things, we see the end product, but probably not so much the work that goes in behind the scenes and, you know, late nights and pressures and phone calls and things like that. So we'll certainly hook into that. But take us back to the start, mate. So I'm assuming you were born at the Burnie Hospital, were you?
I think I was down in Hobart. I was...
Right.
My parents talk about how I was about 7 weeks premature and they're on the East Coast just on a holiday. So I was a bit of a shock for them, I think. So you got down there to Hobart.
Yep.
Quite a few people would probably know my parents. They're both teachers, Mika and Nigel Woolley.
Yep.
Were teachers, both pretty much retired now. It's a bit of relief. So they've been, they played a bit of sport themselves. And it was always destined to have some sort of role in sport, I think, because of their passion for, you know, mum's hockey and dad's been a whole lot of different things with, you know, kayaking and so on. So,
yep. So I was going to ask you that, like, as a child, you were pretty sporty yourself, were you? You would sort of give everything a go, did you?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I loved it. I'd be, training 5 nights a week, as a lot of people were at that time, but I was sort of playing everything. I was playing soccer early, then played footy once I hit high school, played hockey, cricket, anything really, like a lot of people, you can run all day when you're chasing a ball around, can't you? So
absolutely.
Definitely footy became the focus. Was never good enough for your Tassie Mariners or anything like that. Made a few, you know, rep squads, but, you know, just miss out on that. But loved playing at East Devonport, albeit at a time where they were not that great. They did their best work off the field, the East boys. So, yeah, it was a lot of guys that I'm still mates with today from that time.
Yeah.
We had some decent players. We had a few guys from interstate, Jack and Joe Allen, their names were. So you got Trent Allen, who's on the coast still. He owns he's in the fourth pub.
Yeah, he's smashing it now.
Yeah, so they were over. And not a bad team that first year. Second year got a bit more difficult. We had Ash Brown coaching, actually. You'd remember big Ash Brown from the tribe.
Fearsome character.
Yeah, I gave him a shout out on the Truth Hurts. And I got a nice email from him afterwards. Again, just sort of thanking me for that. So it's funny who over time you still, you know, cross paths with 15 years later. So.
Yeah, yep. I reckon the Duck would appreciate him. There was a fair bit of the Duck about Ash Brown. He had a bit of a strut, didn't he? A bit of a fearsome sort of reputation.
Yeah, I mean, Ash was probably even more fierce than the Duck. I mean, the Duck certainly didn't ever took a backward step, but you couldn't do as much on AFL field. But like when you're 17, 18, coming up playing against guys like Ash Brown, like standing in the hole or something like that, you know about it. Like you really respected those guys because, they were good players as well.
Yeah. So as a young fella, mate, was getting into the media always on the radar for you, or was it something that you just sort of fell into over time? What were your ambitions as a young guy?
I mean, perhaps misguidedly, you always think when you're younger, geez, I'd love to play professional sport, but wasn't athletically gifted enough for that. I remember writing something when I was in, might have even been in grade six or grade seven, and one of the teachers at the time said, "Oh, that's really good. Maybe you should have a think about that." And I don't know, it kind of just stuck with me, but I didn't think greatly on it till I left probably year 11, 12, but I knew fair way along that's what I wanted to do. I didn't have, often when you're in year 11 and 12, you don't always know what you want to do, but I was pretty sure of that. And because it involved, I wanted it to involve sport and that sort of thing, then it was a pretty easy do in terms of you know, you're doing something you love. You're doing, you're following, you know, I love footy, I love all of that stuff. So when you get to go to those events, when you, or, you know, go to cricket, test matches or whatever, it's pretty hard to compare to, you know, sitting around an office or something like that sometimes, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. Yeah. You can combine your passion with your work as well, can't you?
Yeah.
And so it wasn't like a straightforward sort of journey into the media though. So you had a gap year for a start, didn't you, before going to uni? So how did that come about?
Yeah, my mates called it a year-long schoolies. So
why finished, not?
We finished year 12. Good mate of mine, Cal Newman, and I went up to Queensland. We played footy up there, and I, you know, we just hunted around for jobs. I ended up working at Bunnings for the year, and I was in the old power garden section selling lawnmowers and stuff.
Yep.
Loved playing footy up there, all sort of expat, you know, Victorians or South Australians or Tasmanians. And other than the end of the year, I played every game that year except for the grand final. I got dropped for the granny, which was being 18 at the time, it was pretty hard to take. But I was in the whole way along, and then they had probably four or five guys come back that didn't play in the prelim.
Yep.
So guys come back from injury and they risked a few. I must admit, I feel bad saying this, but when you get dropped for a granny, you're so conflicted about how the team's going to go on the day.
Yeah. Yep.
They asked me to be the runner, actually, because they wanted me to be involved. And I'd said yes. I wish I didn't. I didn't enjoy it at all.
Yep.
I packed my bag and all that sort of stuff, and, you know, hoping someone would be a late withdrawal. But on the day, I'm going, geez, I don't know if I actually want you guys to win. That's really selfish, but.
I think it's only normal human emotion, though, mate. Like, yeah. I think anyone would sort of have conflicted emotions, wouldn't they? Because if they do win, then you've missed out, haven't you?
Yeah, of course. And like, if they'd won deep down, I would have loved it for all the guys that were there. But also, you're not a part of it. No matter what anyone says, you're not really a part of it unless you're on there on the day.
Yep. Did they end up winning it or not?
No, they didn't. They didn't.
Well, there you go. You didn't have to cross that bridge.
They didn't
you?
Have to worry about it. Didn't have to worry about it. So I just saved my best performance for Mad Monday instead.
Good on you, mate. That's all right. You earned the vote somehow. So from there, it was then down to Melbourne. So you went to RMIT. Was that always on the cards? To had you sort of been accepted and deferred for a year? Was that always?
Yeah, I had. Yep. Yeah, I had. So the reason I had the year off was you got this back of the day, you got this allowance from the government. If you're in your year off, you earn a certain amount of money. So I did that. Went to RMIT. First year I found really helpful. From there, I sort of felt like I was treading water a little bit. And then it was a 3-year course. Third year at the start of it, I didn't really have any experience or anything like that. And I'm sort of scratching my head going, what am I going to do here? Like all the people around me seem to have all this experience, or even just a lot of them, you know, were from Melbourne, so they had different contacts established already. So at that stage, I was thinking, shit, I've got to get my act together here. And it did sort of from there fall into place, thankfully.
Yep. And we'll talk about that in a second and how you sort of got your big break. But you had a few challenges, didn't you, in those early years? Like, it wasn't all straightforward living in Melbourne. Like, you actually had a I don't know what you'd call it, but one of your rental houses came a little bit unstuck at one stage, didn't it?
Yeah, like living away from home, I love living in Queensland, and I love living in Melbourne now, but having your mates, all my mates did human movement, so they're in Launceston.
Yep.
My family's, you know, still on the coast. And so you are pretty isolated initially. A couple of mates. I did have a couple of mates here, and you know, you get in with the footy club here and you get new mates pretty quickly. But, yeah, one of the guys I live with, we came home after a night out, and I've got to be careful what I say because it ended up going through the courts. But little fan force Peter ended up catching on fire in his bedroom. And I'd been back that home that night, and then I went back out to another party. And I got a call when I was at the party saying the house is burnt down. I thought he was pulling the leg, you know, it was pretty late, like 3 or 4 in the morning.
Yeah.
And then I rushed back there to the house, or I got back there, and half of the house wasn't standing, and by that stage the sun was sort of coming up. So there's a bit of light around, you can see smouldering bits of this and that.
No.
Yeah, like you can laugh about it now. At the time, it's a bit of a shock to the system.
Yeah.
My room was about the only room that was still intact, but everything was just black. It was Yeah, pretty scary when you think about it, because he was in his room. He only just woke up and flames.
Oh, so he was actually in the house when it caught on fire.
Yeah, yeah. He's gone and run and tried to get some, you know, he's probably a bit out of his run and tried to get some water to get over the fire, but by the time he got back to his room, you know, the whole room was alight. So
yeah, right.
Yeah. Like the next day, straight away, you're thinking, what am I going to do? Like, all my stuff's wrecked and I've got nowhere to live. And, you know, I think we had backup plans of family that were, you know, cousins and all that sort of thing. But it was more just like the shock of, geez, you could have been in that. You know, could have been much worse.
Yeah, absolutely. Character building, mate. We'll put it down to that.
Exactly.
And you talked about work experience again, just coming back to your transition into the media. Is that a big thing for people getting into the media? Like, it might have changed these days, but back then, was it more about sort of who you knew and who could sort of open doors for you?
Yeah, I mean, I find that is a huge, huge thing, and that's
that know, still is.
I think so.
Yep.
Massively. And I think that's why in Melbourne, particularly, there's such a divide between public and private schools, which is maybe not as pronounced in Tassie. You know, I went to Reece and Don College, you know, they're fine for me. But when you compare them to some of the schools that are over here, you know, there's huge discrepancies in terms of money and all that sort of stuff.
Yep.
But I think people go to those schools over here for their contacts. They've got pre-established contacts with people who are in positions of power or who are heading up different, you know, networks or whatever. So, I found that challenging initially, and because I didn't have any. I was coming in fresh, and I was, when we get to the next part, the way that Tony Jones would describe me is he reckons he had to knock a bit of Tassie out of me when we first started. I never thought I had a particular, you know, twang or anything like that, but apparently I'd not slur my words a bit more, but I'm a bit lazier with my speech, and there's a different way of talking, supposedly.
Yeah, well, we'll get into that, because that's always fascinated me, how our newsreaders talk. But so you ended up doing your work experience at RSN now, but what was it called back in the day?
Yeah, 927. So the racing station, basically, you know, where you get all your odds and your races. That stage they had a breakfast sports show. Well, they still do. It's a little bit different now. But then, it was Tony Jones was hosting.
Yep.
With Michael Christian, who, you know, ex Collingwood, who's now the head of the match, he's a match review officer.
Yep.
So they've been doing it for a few years. And I went in there not really knowing much about it. You get in there at, you know, 5 o'clock in the morning, they're on air from 5:30.
Sorry, mate, just to take you back, did you have to contact them and organise that, or how did you?
That was through the uni.
Okay.
That was through the uni. So I put in for I didn't really know exactly where I wanted to work. I just knew it was sport. And that was like the TV networks were sort of really hard to get your work placements, as were, you know, your Herald Sun and those sort of places. So I picked this place knowing that no one else would really in my group would want to go for it, thinking it just could be a good leg in the door. And that's how it turned out. Yeah, I'd been there about 15 minutes, I think, you know, early in the morning, there's probably not as many people listening. So Tony Jones thought he could take a bit more of a risk on air, but he said, oh, we've got this new work experience kid in from RMIT, Ayrton Woolley. Come in, Ayrton. So he got me in there, hadn't told me he was going to get me on. Then I was on for about 10, 15 minutes, just him asking me about my name and my life and all that sort of thing. And he must have seen something, because it was before the end of, and even the end of the show that he asked if I wanted to come along and try my luck at Channel 9.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that. Has he ever sort of spoken to you about what he saw in you? Because it's only like a little small sample size. He must have done something that made you stand out to him.
Yeah, I mean, they were looking for someone who was, you know, very much entry level, who could help out as distinct from someone being established. But I think the way I spoke when I was on air, I'd like to think I'm a pretty confident person. So I guess that probably helped at the time. And I think there's a big bit of right place, right time. I mean, he's
absolutely,
we've spoken about that since, and he said, well, yeah, you made the most of your opportunity. Like, it might not have worked out if you weren't the right fit, but bit of luck there as well.
So just talk to us about your transition then into Channel 9, but you went to the World Cup first and then you came back. Is that right?
Yeah, so I'd already booked to go to the Soccer World Cup in South Africa. That was just solo trip. I went with the Fanatics for a couple of weeks and then basically just travelled around on my own. that was awesome. Tony at that stage had said, look, we're keen for you to, I've done a couple of weekends, but that's maybe 2 weekends by that stage. He said, no guarantee it'll still be here when you get back. I was like, well, I can't really pull out of this trip now. You know, I've spent all this money on it. I got back. At that stage, I was filling in an RSN as well. And I'd have a lot of different times where I'd do the breakfast show as, you know, Tony is just this incredibly hard worker. And for him, work is almost like his life. And so because he did it, it was almost expected that, you would do it. So I'd go in and I'd get in at 4:45 for the radio. That'd finish at 9:00. Then I'd go straight to Channel 9 and that'd finish at 6:30. And so they're fair old days. And when you have to produce radio and organise guests and do that stuff and then work at Channel 9, it was pretty pretty taxing. But earlier Channel 9 was, it was really basic stuff. Back then we were still on camera tape. So my job might be as basic as, I still find it amazing that in 2010, Channel 9 was on was on VHS basically. Yep. The way they did it, if the grand final was on, you would put in a VHS into the recorder and you would record the game. And then you would have to go and, you know, when you came time to cut your story, you would go and give it to the editor, that one particular tape. And on grand final day, it'd be mayhem because there'd be about 5 different editors that need the grand final footage for different stories. And there's this one tape that, so you're almost like, it's pretty basic stuff at that stage. You think there's not much to that. You'd watch the game and you'd that stage in the office and you'd write down, you know, when something happened, when someone kicked a goal or, and so then that makes it easier for the person doing the package or edit and to edit it to go back and find the vision to go with it. So that's sort of all I did to start off with. All the while I was sort of working on my voice.
Yep.
I thought my voice was fine, but when you go to try and do a news voice, you've got to be much more level and you find that you have different inflections and the way you speak doesn't always suit a news report. So I found that really hard. It was difficult to, you've got to try and retain your natural voice. You know, you don't want to put it on too much, but you've got to have a certain projection, a certain, you know, levelness to your voice. And it took me several months before they even thought about putting me on air.
So I wanted to ask you about that because I remember one day I was watching a reporter, that I can't remember what it was at, but they were standing there in front of a camera and they'll count down, you know, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. But she was just talking to her crew just like you and I are talking now. And then suddenly the camera started rolling and the voice just completely changed. So it just I just always thought, why can't they just talk in their normal voices? Is it just the way it's always been, or does it just come across better in the media? Or
if you do a live cross, for instance, where you're, you know, as you're speaking, it's going to air, then often you are it's more conversational and you are talking as you talk. But when you record your voice, often you can find it's really flat or your words go up at the wrong point in terms of, you know, pitch or whatever, and it just doesn't sound right. It really grates your ears and it's hard to listen to. So when you do those pre-recorded segments, which we call packages, you've got to have a level of voice training before you can nail it. Unless, you know, some people come in and they can do it pretty well, but most people, and some people never make it. You know, we've had people that came in and they could be really good reporters in terms of getting stories, but they could just never get the presenting side.
Yep. So is it more about sort of staying between the lines, sort of, that you can't get too high, can't get too low. You've got to keep yourself pretty, like,
level. Yeah. Yeah. Certain pace. Yeah, it's very easy to be monotone as well. You don't have to be boring.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of different factors.
So your first story that went to air, though, you told me that was after your first Channel 9 Christmas party. So did you know that you were going to go to air the next day?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I did. My we just had a new news director who's the head of the department at that time, and he and Tony had decided I was ready to go. And of course, no one really wants to work the day after the Christmas party. I think that's why I was given the opportunity. Back then, the Channel 9 Christmas parties were like really lavish sort of affairs. You know, Channel 9, everyone used to talk about the old Channel 9. And this was back when, you know, the Kerry Packer days, when, you know, you probably only had 3 or 4 stations. There's no internet, no streaming. And so you would get 1 million people a night watching the news.
Yeah.
Now it might be 300,000 or 400,000 on a good night. So that's why, you know, it's more than half. That's why, you know, money is very tight in TV now, just because people are going to different. But anyway, back then Christmas party was a huge huge do at the old town line in Richmond. So it's funny that they moved out of that after about a year, that place. I'm glad I got a year there, because it was, you walk the halls of it and you can tell you're a part of history, and you're around all the different studios. You know, they did Hey Hey Saturday, the footy show. You know, you'd walk past and then be Bert Newton's dressing room, or so there'd be, it was like a rabbit line. There were just dressing rooms for all these different stars everywhere. Now it's much more sterile. There's one big studio that they record all the shows at, and the newsroom is very separate. So, but yeah, anyway, back to the Christmas party. I mean, I love a drink, but that night I kept it in check. Yeah, a few people were coming up to me. It's funny, like I had never met Eddie McGuire, and that night for the first time, Tony said, oh, this is it, and he's going to do his first story tomorrow. And so then Eddie, you know, I'm chatting to Eddie for the next half an hour about, you know, he's giving you all this advice. Of, you know, if you're not breaking the story in this town, you're a nobody, son. You know, I always remember that his first conversation. I thought, I don't know if I'm going to scale the heights that you have, Eddie, but yeah, that was the next day too. My last line of my story was about Greg Norman. He missed this easy putt. My mates would never forgive me, never forget it. I said he might add a new putter to his Christmas list. Here you are, this upstart, writing his first story, and you're going Australia's greatest golfer at the time. He might need to go get a new putter.
This episode of the pod wouldn't be possible without the support of Alex, Sammy and the team at Shearwater Health and Fitness. Everyone needs a little bit of help and support at times, especially when it comes to health and wellness. Not only is Shearwater Health and Fitness supporting the Talkard podcast, but more importantly, they're committed to providing Shearwater and the surrounding community with a premium quality health and wellness facility. If you've been looking to take the first step or even the next step in your health and wellness journey, they provide a full class timetable, 24/7 gym, infrared sauna, Normatec recovery boots and a massage therapist. Something for everyone, whether you're a high performance athlete, mum, dad, or just someone wanting to help be the best version of yourself. Call in and see them at 24 Shearwater Boulevard, which is right next door to the IGA, or you can check them out on Instagram and Facebook for all the details.
Was it always the sport that you wanted to get into? Like, you never thought about going into like political sort of journalism or any other sort of current affairs or anything like that?
No, always sport for me. Yeah, that's where my passion was. I at that stage, what I wanted to do was more so than news was commentary, which I've done bits and pieces of along the way. Still, you know, a possibility in the future. I mean, I describe that as even more competitive, that sort of field. I knew it was sport. You know, I looked up to, you know, like your Bruce McAvaney's and these types are doing the footy, you're doing the races, doing all sorts of different sport. And you think that's pretty cool. And having had a taste of it, it's a nice world to be in. It's like news. You're very self-sufficient. You go out and get your own stuff, your own stories. You look after yourself. You defend for yourself. In those worlds, everything's laid on for you. Nice world to be in if you can make it.
Yeah. I suppose it's all coming to you. You've just got to call what's in front of you, don't you?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And so you said that you've had a little bit of a go at commentary, have you? So what, how did that come about?
Yeah, well, a few different things. Like you do boundaries, not, you know, like boundary for AFL games, you know, when you're doing injury updates on the sidelines if someone goes off, whatever. Did some soccer stuff when Channel 9 had a few friendlies, you know, when Tottenham and a few other teams came out. And then Channel 9 had the netball for a few years. It's funny, I never thought I'd be commentating netball, but at the time I actually really enjoyed it. I did it for a year and a half while someone was overseas, and that was great fun. So I've done a lot more practice that haven't done any footy for anyone. News has sort of like, that was quite a few years ago now, and then news has sort of become even more competitive and more all consuming since then.
Yeah, it's certainly taken off, and that was one thing that I did want to explore with you. But so, just through your time in covering sport in the news side of it, was it 13 years all up that you've worked in that space?
13 years. Yep. Yeah.
Yep. So, what are some of the things that you have covered, mate? I know you've done some pretty big stories along the journey.
Yeah, I mean, the things I think about and look back with the most sort of pride, I guess, COVID was a difficult time. We were classed as essential workers, and so we kept working right through, even though all of Victoria was locked down. And, you know, coming up with stories at that time was tough, but then it did create some opportunities. I got to go away to the Queensland hub So footy moved, you know, obviously moved to Queensland for 4 months. I was up there.
Yep.
That was awesome. You know, I was sort of the only person on the ground. You're working every day for 4 months and there's 10 clubs up there. Yep. That was cool. And then did it again the next year when the footy went to Sydney and went to Perth. And
yeah.
These guys have done that. So yeah, but the other stuff like, you know, test matches, getting out of the first day and night test in Adelaide. That was pretty cool. You know, been to, plenty of those sort of matches. I was down in Hobart when Australia played South Africa, which doesn't sound like an overly, big game or anything, but Australia got absolutely pumped and they lost the series, the first time they'd lost at home in years and years and years, and created this big inquiry. So that was, you know, all that sort of stuff went, especially when you're younger, it sort of, you know, it was a bit of a buzz to be a part of that, because you're doing it at that stage, not just for Melbourne, you're doing it for the whole network.
Yeah, absolutely. And you talked about the why you got out of it for a little bit of a break in that. Like, talk to us about the amount of pressure that you're under as a reporter to sort of get your stories in time, and the different pressures that you guys have that people wouldn't even know about.
Yeah, I mean, that's the big one. And I looked even recently at someone like Tommy Brown from Channel 7, who cops a lot, Tommy, and I does. Would say deservedly so at times with his... with his Twitter work. I hope Tommy won't mind me saying that. He's someone that, it's funny, like
he won't be listening, mate. You'll be right.
Early doors, he and I sort of came in at a similar time. And so I think he viewed me as some sort of rival. And he's a different guy, Tommy. And so we often clashed. So he was working for Channel 7, I worked for Channel 9. We'd often clash. And even towards the end, you know, you sort of still do. So every day is this competition between you and Channel 7 over what you can get. So the pressure for stories was immense. Like every day you start again. That was the big thing. You could have a great day. You could break, this coach is, you know, being appointed here or being sacked, or this player is doing this, or but the next day it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Because you work to 6 PM and your day is, that's why I always feel like it's different to a normal work day. A normal work day, often you get your work in early and you maybe taper off as the day progresses, whereas a news day would get busier and more hectic, and that last hour is often really busy, and then you might have to do a live cross. They generally do a live cross every night. So that does wear you down. I'd spend hours and hours in car parks, and it sounds really grubby, and that was the stuff that I didn't love. You know, someone's injured. Darcy Moore's done his hamstring. You might go to the club, and often the players are getting earlier and earlier. So you go to the club at 7 o'clock in the morning. You might have just missed him going in, and then there's not really else much around that day. I really need to talk to him. And Channel 7.
He's going to come back out.
He's going to come back out. He might not come out till 4 o'clock, but you don't know. Some days you don't know their schedule. So this is a balancing act. And that's the hard thing. You know, morally and sort of ethically, I'd say a lot of the best journos in terms of breaking stories maybe didn't worry about that as much. I don't want to put them all in the same basket. I found that really hard because I knew the players didn't, you know, they didn't like the media. And I think in a lot of cases, fair enough. And I always used to compare them to my mates. I think these guys are the same age as me or my mates, and I know what we're out doing on a weekend and the level of scrutiny these guys are under, and you think, I'm chasing you for this, when you see it every weekend from normal people. So, definitely grappled with that over time, and definitely part of the reasoning as to why I wanted to find something new.
And you've got to have a lot of tenacity to do it. Like you said, you've got to, I suppose, deal with a lot of rejection and a lot of people, you know, not being that keen to talk to you. It's funny that I have you on, because when I was a young fella, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a sports reporter. I actually did all my work experience at The Advocate. But the amount of knockbacks and things that you get, I look at that now like you've got to have a really thick skin, which I wouldn't have. Like, it would wear me down really quickly, you know, if somebody said, "Nah, piss off, mate, I'm not going to talk to you," and that sort of thing. You really have to deal with a lot of that, don't you?
Oh, absolutely, you do. Yeah, and I found that really early on. News changed, so we were half-hour news initially, and really the type of footy stories, you almost took what you could get. The clubs would put out a media release saying, Coach Mick Malthouse will speak at this time. and you go and do that and you sort of have enough to get you by, then the other only big stuff you'd cover would be big controversies. Yep. And, you know, big ones that were early doors were, you know, the St Kilda schoolgirl stuff. The Essendon saga was a huge one, and that was really draining.
But and then you're an Essendon man too. That would be more draining for you.
Yeah, James Shedd was my idol when I was growing up. And so thankfully I never had to do his house. So I tried to make the distinction for me personally, and you didn't always have the option depending on what your news director said. But I would, in my mind, justify hitting up a player at a club because I would think that's an extension of their workplace, of which they're being, you know, they're being paid big dollars, and media is part of that. Whereas I always thought homes were, I never loved that, and I avoided it as best I could. But, you know, yeah. James said to have people outside his house every day while the Essendon saga was on, because every now and then he would talk, and so then the chief of staff would say, well, what if he says something today? You know, we can't not be there. You know, Channel 7 will be there. And I hated that time because, you know, every night something new would come out about Essendon and Stephen Dank and what drug had been injected, or, you know, supposedly what this ban or that ban, and you'd be back at the footy club again. It's definitely a fine line with that sort of stuff. But in terms of rejection, when you're younger, people don't know who you are. And so you might ask a player, do you mind stopping for a chat? And no, mate. Well, back then often you didn't even have that relationship. You'd just go up, barrel up, you know, bullet a gate. No, Nick Rewalt, what do you think about this or whatever? And then he's looking at you like you're an idiot, and it's probably fair enough. Whereas over time, they recognise your face, they get to know your name, and you might see them at functions or the races or wherever, and so they get to know that you're not necessarily a bad person. So if it's, often Scott Pendlebury or, you know, Dyson Heppel, they were good ones where they knew they were sort of the face of the club, and if they spoke, then often their teammates wouldn't have to worry. So you go there after a loss, you know, Scott, you mind if we just have a brief chat? And you know it's not going to go forever. It might be 3 or 4 or 5 questions, and that's all we need. And then we move on, and takes the heat off everyone else. And he's smart enough that he doesn't, he'll only say something, you know, controversial or whatever if he wants to.
Yeah.
But definitely got into blues with coaches, media managers. Media managers are the big ones when you're outside a footy club waiting for something and they don't want you to talk to them.
Yep. And they just come to you to piss off, do they?
Yeah, pretty much. And sometimes the players will do that. And you're like, well, I've got no choice. One day I didn't have a story at all. I'd been in Geelong all day. I was head of the grand final when Steve Johnson had his, Steve Johnson was fighting to be fit with a knee problem. He'd hurt his knee.
Yep.
He ended up coming in and playing, kicking 4 goals, I think, when Geelong won the flag. But during the week, he just trained. We're locked out of training. I'm waiting there at the car park. And then there's Steve Johnson, and he's seen me. He's gone to go one way. So I've gone to go one way to follow him, and he's doubled back to go the other way. And then
give the knee a good workout.
This sort of standoff. And I'm just saying, Steve, I just need you to answer one question, mate. Like, you'll just make my year if you just do this for me. If I go back with nothing, like, I'm in so much strife. Well, that's what the smart ones understand. If they just give you a bit, then that's all you need.
Yeah. And I was going to ask you just about the different sports people. How important is it to build relationships with certain sports people in order to get them to stop and chat? Like you said, if you're the new kid on the block and you don't have the relationship with them, then they're more likely to brush past you. Is that something that is a focus in the media now, to actually get to know the guys a little bit?
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, that's the advantage the journalists had in the early 90s and late 80s, when there was not this saturation of footy media. Now there's, you know, there's more accredited footy media than there are players.
Yep.
And everyone's just scrapping for these different stories. There's so many people covering footy, and there's all this, sort of shock-jock footy chat now. So it makes it much harder to have those relationships. It was back in the day that, your Eddie McGuire's and these guys, they're going out with the players every weekend. And because journalists weren't necessarily the enemy, it wasn't that same culture. So,
yeah,
definitely important, though. And you find that, often it's as simple as, I'd be at a function for something. The races, you'd be in the same marquee and they recognise you, and often you just let them go about their business, but sometimes you just end up bumping into them and talking, and that can be that can help you down the line. They realise you're not a bad person, and they might end up stopping for you, or at least it's not as adversarial, it's not as aggro if they're saying no.
Well, what about bad experiences? Like, are you prepared to sort of name up some of the ones that have been pretty ordinary to you, or is that sort of still a bit of a touchy subject?
I mean, the big one that stands out for me, and people can look this one up because it's very accessible on YouTube. Yeah, I went out to Essendon, and John Worsfold, he was under the club was not going very well. There'd been a report about a disconnect. I'm going on memory here. I think between either the coaching box and the players, or the senior coach and some of the assistants, or something like that. I think it was Paul Ruse that had said it, but I'd have to go back and check who'd said it at the time. And this is a bit of a lesson. And normally I'm super prepared for, because you know when they're going to be a bit feisty, you've got to come ready. And when they bite back at you and you ask a question, you sort of have two options. You can either, some people just go in their shell and completely back down, or you keep going back.
Yep.
Here's an example with Nick Malthouse like that in a second, but with Worcester that day, I'd said, oh, there's been reports of, disconnect between, he says, by whom? I said, oh, they've reported it. I couldn't remember who had said it. By whom? And it just kept going for like five times. He was just on a mission that day, because he did it to other journos that day, just not as bad. And mine was the one that got played. And that, it just kept going and going, and it was completely embarrassing for me. My social media lit up that day. I had hundreds of comments on Twitter and Facebook and everywhere, just slamming me from Bomber fans. I just want to say, fellas, I'm a Bomber. I just want the best for the club, you know. that was one. But yeah, in terms of getting that respect from them and being prepared, like Mick Malthouse, he was one very early on who was around. I actually quite enjoyed going to his media conferences because he always give you a bit. But I remember the first time I did one with him, and he'd always, if he noticed someone new, he would always not target them, but he would test them. And so this was in the Collingwood boardroom, mix at one end, and the rest of the journals are at one end sitting down. And I'd asked Mick a question, can't remember what it was about, and he went back at me. And thankfully, I knew the top. I feel like I have a good footy knowledge. I went back and said, clarified what I meant. And from then on, it was like he'd given me a pass. Like, oh, this person, he's not an idiot. So, I won't treat him like one. Whereas you feel like if you'd failed that little test, then you could see it with other people. If he could tell they didn't know, he just wouldn't suffer fools. On a personal level, Wish is the one that stands out, but a heap of other. I mean, Hawthorn were notoriously prickly in the Alistair Clarkson days. Yeah, and that sort of came through with the players as well. He told a couple of colleagues to fuck off one day, which is that one of them was a Hawthorn supporter, and he was pretty rattled by that. Thank you. It sort of comes with the territory though. Like you understand it if it's, because there are times like grand final week where Cyril Rioli's fighting to be fit. And Hawthorn, I don't know if you've seen how Waverley Park is now, but Waverley now is surrounded by houses.
Yeah.
Hawthorn having these closed sessions. And so you'd start out in the open going, well, I'm not being deceptive. I'll just film until you tell me to get lost. So Clarko or Chris Fagan, who might have been there at the time too, to come and get lost. And then one year another journo's gone door knocking on houses and asking people if they could film from their living rooms, looking out over the...
Sitting there with a cup of tea.
They end up getting this old couple let one of our cameras in. We've got this amazing vision of Cyril doing this fitness test. But then when you go to Hawthorn the next time, like Clarko hasn't forgotten it. And if he knows it was on Channel 9, you're holding the Channel 9 mic, then good luck with that. But, yeah, I mean, plenty of others with players. I was trying to think of them before. I mean, there'd be hundreds of little mini blow-ups. But most of the time, in the end, you learn who to target and who not to, and who you're going to get a response from and who not to. Like Dustin Martin, for instance, you just know that Dustin is not going to say a word to you.
Yeah.
No matter what the circumstances are, one day you just go, Dusty, good to be back. Just silence.
Yep.
And so in the end, you just let him go.
Yeah. Yeah. I suppose it's like in any like workplace, isn't it? You learn, they're all different personalities. You just learn how to roll with different ones, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And like Wusha was, I don't think he wasn't a bad guy. I just think that day he was out there to prove a point. I was chatting to one of the players about it later, and they said he went out there and said, "Oh, yeah, I just gave it to the media out there. Just absolutely give it to this one bloke in the presser. I'm backing you in, boys. I'm backing you in." So it was like an us versus them. You know, they play all these mind games, and the media are a part of that.
Yeah. And there's some clubs that are more media friendly than others, aren't they? Like, I know, you know, just listening to a couple of things on the radio and stuff, there's some that they can never get an interview out of, where there's others that,
yeah, absolutely,
that are more upfront with that sort of thing.
Yeah, Hawthorn were difficult, and they had the advantage of an underground car park, and so the player, you never knew the players, so they didn't have the same incentive. And because they were winning at the time, you know, they had that great era under Alistair Clarkson, they felt like they didn't need it. They were getting the coverage anyway. You know, the smaller clubs will likely help you out, your North Melbournes, because they know they need. But then, you know, they go through phases depending on who the coach is. You know, often the guys that have come out of the Clarko school, like your Damien Hardwicks, don't love media. He's a good media performer now, but he doesn't, you know. So Richmond, you know, be difficult at times. Carlton were difficult at times. But yeah, you got to pick your battles. You got to pick your battles.
How scary is it in this day and age how much we rely on modern technology? It's not till your phone dies or the Wi-Fi or power goes off that you realise you'd be lost without it. Well, recently my phone decided in its old age to die and stop charging, and on a weekend no less. So what do? Rather than waiting to speak to the network providers or retail outlets, which can be painful within itself, give Brad or Katie a call at Greenies Apple Repairs. That's what I did, and they had my old phone as good as new in hours. Greenies take care of iPhones, iPods, iPads, and pretty much everything else, and they won't cost you an arm and a leg. So next time you're stuck back in the dark ages with no technology, contact Greenies Apple Repairs on 0401 229 220, or you can contact them at www.greeniesrepairs.com.au or find them on Facebook. Now just to get onto this busted screen.
Just last one on that, mate. If you do sort of break someone's trust, how hard is it to get that back and to be able to get in with them if you do sort of get one of them offside? Or do you have to sort of write that off as like, well, yeah, I'm probably not going to be able to approach him again?
I mean, it depends how bad.
Yep.
I haven't, you know, I've got things wrong over time and had to make apologies to people, and they've probably wiped me from then on, but they've been respectful enough to talk to me when I talk to them, but they're probably never going to be someone of, I say, useful to you, but they're probably never, you're never going to, relationship's never going to be the same.
Yep.
But I think for the most part, disagreements happen so often.
Yep.
That it is like water under a bridge a lot of the time, because you're working with these people it's a high pressure environment. They're protecting their patch. You're trying to get what you want, and at the end of the day, they do understand it. Most people do. So it might take some time. Even when early in the year, I don't think you mind me saying it. Brady Rawlings, so he's a fellow Northwest Coaster, risk manager at North Melbourne. I did a report about North meeting with Riley Bonner, and it could be part of the Jason Horne Francis trade. And Brady sent me a message that night, suggesting my journalistic skills may need some work in perhaps less flattering terms. And like for me, that rattles you when that happens. It does happen. I different spats I've had. Like there was a 24-hour period once where Peter Moore, Darcy Moore's dad, had just gone on radio on SEN, and he'd spoken really openly about how Darcy was playing forward at that time, about how hard it was for forwards to play. He said, you wouldn't want to be a forward in this Collingwood team. And it was kind of really, Nathan Buckley was coach at the time, and it didn't really reflect well on Bucks and Bucks' game plan. It was like he was really critical of Bucks' game plan. I gave Peter a call and said, would you mind coming on camera? And said, so it's not just radio for us, and sort of having a chat about that. And he's like, no, I'd prefer not to. And I don't think he'd realised how hard he'd gone.
Yep.
That night I used the radio grabs, and I framed it like a million other people did that day. I didn't report it any differently to anyone else, but because I'd called him, he called me that night and said, what's this about you saying? I said, Nathan Buckley can't coach. And I said, Peter, I just reported what you said. And then he just launched at me like swearing, non-stop for a couple of minutes. Like, if you ever fucking want anything from me ever again, I'm never going to answer your call, or, I don't think you're going to get anything from our family, and blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, safe to say I wasn't ringing Peter Moore after that. But then the next day, Tim Cahill, I think he might have quit Melbourne City to go overseas, to go and play overseas, or something had happened with Tim Cahill. And it was one of those ones where we had to go to his house, and I hated this, but the Channel 7 had a derno there too with Tommy Brown that day. And we'd been sitting there for a few hours. He had a really long drive over. We didn't go onto his property, waiting for him to come out thinking he would have seen us, and he'll either tell us to leave or, I think it's Tim Cahill. He's a different guy. He might give us something. Anyway, I was getting later in the day, and I actually started thinking about, I knew he had kids. Someone left around school pickup time. I thought, they're probably going to get his kids. I don't want to be here when his kids get home, because that's, I thought that's another line again. So if we're going to do anything, let's do it now so we can just leave. And so he went up, and Tommy was scared, so he went back 10 metres, and I went and knocked on his front door. And nothing happened for a second. Then I heard this sort of noise to my right, and I didn't realise, because his front door was in a little alcove. On the right was a huge window into his lounge room. And I just looked to my right, and there's Tim Cahill standing up on his couch, like, going, what the fuck? He was livid.
Yeah.
Like, absolutely livid, which I understand. You know, it's his house. It's his home. It's his safe place. He came out absolutely talking threads off me. So when I had Peter Moore and Tim Cahill in space 24 hours do that to me, I was pretty flat for a couple of days after that.
I reckon.
Yeah, I mean, it's maybe a bit different to your question about, because I was probably never going to have their trust anyway. I was never going to deal with them enough that it was an issue. But they do rattle you from time to time, absolutely.
Yeah. I was going to ask you that. Has there been any other instances that has really sort of affected you, or are they probably the worst ones you can brush off pretty quick?
Probably those ones. I mean, there was a time there are other times I've been really nervous about different things, like about whether my actions might have unforeseen consequences in the hub. The quarantine issue in the hub was huge. So when we first went to Queensland, we didn't have to quarantine, but we were very separate from the players. Whereas in Perth, for instance, we actually did the 14-day quarantine in a hotel room. That was, and I'm glad I did it. It was an experience.
Didn't you have a PlayStation?
Yeah, I took the PlayStation over. Funny, the routine you get into, I you could hire a bike. I'd do an hour on the bike. I'd make the calls, do a few, Zoom interviews. You play your PlayStation. Then I'd set up my little laptop and stuff, doing this makeshift live cross from a balcony by the end of the day. Anyway, I've gone the long way around that story. But in Queensland, when we first got there, the players are in quarantine, but we'd got up there before you needed to quarantine. And so we were not allowed to have any contact with the players. Then Patrick Cripps, Carlton's had this awesome win. Patrick Cripps is walking along this path, which is just, well, I'm on the road. There's a hedge, and then he's on the other side of the hedge in his hotel. I said, Paddy, if we get the, I used to get the old long pole mics out while COVID was on. If we don't jump over, do you mind if we do this interview? He said, no worries. And did this great interview, so up and about. And then I've got a call 2 hours later from the AFL saying, you can't put that to air. And I was like, what do you mean? And they said, if that goes to air, the Queensland government might cancel. They might say, no, teams are not. Because the players, and they were suggesting that we were, mingling with the public, and the players weren't, because remember when COVID was just this, it was just, you can't come into contact with them. And so they said, the Queensland government's watching us like a hawk. We actually think Paddy's breached the COVID protocols. We might have to suspend him for a week. And I'm thinking, imagine if I and Carlton just had this awesome win after being under pressure, and I'm the one responsible for Paddy Cripps sitting out the next week with a suspension. I'm thinking, like, that'd be I'd feel horrific for him, but it'd be terribly embarrassing for me as well. Thankfully, he just got a warning, and he was just reminded of his responsibilities. But in those moments, you go, that could have been pretty bad.
And do you have any strategies to deal with any of those tough times, mate, or do you normally brush them off pretty quickly? Do you have any go-tos to work through things when you sort of are sat on your ass a bit?
I feel like I tend to get on with it pretty quick. The Woosha one, that just the sheer volume of social media stuff for a day, I was just a bit rattled. I was never depression or anything like that. You're just a bit down for a couple of days, but you realize you've got to get back on the horse. And I think that's kind of born out of when you have all these disagreements or clashes in a high pressure environment. If you don't move on, you'll never get anywhere anyway. Like, I don't think Tony Jones would mind me saying, like, he was a great mentor for me, and I'll be forever grateful for what he did. But we, especially early on, we would clash so much. He's very headstrong. So was I wouldn't back down in certain circumstances if I thought that we were doing something the wrong way.
So it's not just on the footy show that he gets prickly. He's like that sometimes behind closed doors.
Yeah. With all due respect to Talk Hard, I don't know if Tony will be tuning in. I don't want to talk out of school about Tony.
He's not on our list of followers so far, but you never know, mate. He takes an interest in you. So
there's different times where you pick your battles in that environment, and sometimes you just got to cop it on the chin and move on really quickly. Other times you stand up for yourself and you take a stand. Those times are definitely harder, and a news environment is a high pressure environment, because you every day, if you don't have your story ready to the second, then you have problems. No lasting effects for me. So I feel a little bit fortunate in that regard, that from a mental point of view, I feel like I've always been okay. But I guess it has, over time, it's built up enough that I've quit my job without having something else there, which people have said is a risk. Like, it's probably unusual to quit your job and not have another job to go to. Yep. And now, there's some certain financial realities that I've got to come to terms with.
Yep.
Just
with the knockbacks that you get, does that wipe a few sort of newbies out, do you think? Like, they sort of filters a few of the starters out, like they quit pretty early because they can't sort of handle the heat?
Absolutely. Yeah. And you see, when I made that comparison before with who I would describe as the best newsbreakers, and I've heard Craig Hutchison talk about this on his podcast. And he's got some great stories, but he would be relentless in his phone calling of people. Tom Brown would be another who would think nothing of ringing the same person 10 times in 20 minutes.
Yep.
I might ring twice and write a message, because I think that's a reasonable thing to do. Yep. But it might not always get you the story. And so people, when they are copying grief and copying that social media backlash, you'd see a lot of people that think this is not for me. It's you got to have thick skin, absolutely. And you know what social media is like now. You can be 100% right about something on social media, and people will still slam you, or the club will refute it. But the clubs are protecting their interests, and it might come out 6 months later that you were right. But it doesn't matter then. You've copped all the grief from the supporters.
And you talk about the social media age that we're in. It's certainly a different world. Like, it's a constant news script stream now, isn't it? Like, people used to have to wait till 6:30 of a night to get their news. But with news being like 24/7 these days, obviously the pressure, there's so much pressure on you guys to be the first ones to break a story. Do you think that reporting and news has lost its quality a little bit? The fact that people have to sort of rush news through now, and it might not be, if it's 85% right, they're prepared to go with it.
Absolutely. Yeah, and there's a lot more opinion now too, which is what really riles people up. We've got shows, hours and hours of shows where people are fighting to have the next biggest opinion too.
Opinion becomes news, doesn't it?
Opinion becomes news. Yeah. And often those people are speculating, but then it's passed off as a report as well. Yeah. There's different to, there's different stuff that I didn't go with at different times that, I go in hindsight, maybe I should. I was quite conservative with that, and maybe to my detriment at times. But then you'd weigh up the different circumstances. Like, one time I had found out Bailey Smith had got into a fight on the Gold Coast, and he was the absolute pin-up boy at the time. The Dogs had just played in the grand final, and had it all firmed up that he got into this fight, and then the club sort of said, oh no, he didn't instigate it. There's nothing really in it. But I had the police for investigating it. And, you know, it's a story every day, but I kind of thought, oh, maybe I'll let this one slide. You know, it got reported the next day in the Herald Sun. Because I wasn't 100% sure about whether he wasn't the instigator or the instigator, I didn't do it. Whereas I feel like a lot more people would have run that type of thing. So yeah, this journos make a lot of, journos get a bad rap, and I think some of it is fair. A lot of the time they'll end up being right, but then the times that they aren't, yeah, it is bad because it affects people's lives. There's also, in terms of how stories are broken, there's a lot of different ways that it can happen, and this can affect it as well, because sometimes you've got a bit of information that someone's telling you is fact and you have no reason to disbelieve them, but that they're using you to their own end as well. You know, managers are very sneaky in terms of the information they put out there, and to whether they want to get their player a better contract. So they might be saying such and such as put in an offer of $1 million a year when it might not be that high, and they want the club that they're already at to offer a better deal, you know what I mean? Or they might deny certain allegations, or you might be put onto something else as a distraction. So there's a whole lot of little games that get played. And again, you know, Craig Hutchison, I feel like he's been the master of that over time. And he would talk about, you think you have a good story, and you go to that person and they say, oh yeah, well, that's true, but I reckon I've got a better one for you. And so they say, if you don't run that story, I'll give you this one. It's often how stories come about. It's
right.
Yeah. So it's funny, the games that are played. In answer to your original question, definitely journos, there's not the same fact checking. Cause yeah, it was either back then it was 6 PM news or the front page of the paper, and always just to talk to the newspaper journos. And if you had something on the front, on the back page, and it was wrong, it sat there for a bloody long time. You know what I mean? Like you put an article online now, if it's wrong, you can take it down.
Yeah,
you couldn't do it back then.
No, and you talked about there before canning a story because you weren't 100% sure that it was right. Have there been any that you are 100% sure that they're right, but you still didn't go with them because you thought it was going to affect that person in a very negative way? You don't obviously have to go through the specifics, but
no, I mean you learn a lot of things that you know to be true, but yeah, you. There are different circumstances. I mean, sometimes I remember the day that John McCarthy, ex-Port Adelaide, that's his name, isn't it? When he passed away. And so, you know, we knew that really early in the day, and we could have reported it, but you respect, they've got to let the next of kin know. And so you do that in that circumstance, absolutely, because, you know, it's literally life and death sort of stuff, and it's really hard on families. Other ones, if it's contracts or injuries, I feel like if you've got that stuff, you go with it. It would only be if it's really personal. Sometimes if there were different health things, you don't, like if someone misses training, it's a bit of intrigue, but then you get told, oh, he's actually got this health issue, but we appreciate if you don't, then you don't, you respect that. And that, the more you do that for clubs, then the more it's likely to come back to you in, you know, later on when you do press them on something else.
Yep. One other thing that you spoke to me about is managing egos. Can you sort of unpack that a little bit for us, like how that works in this game?
I think that's a huge part of it. I don't know. I feel like every walk of life has different people, people who are a bit strange. You're probably coming across in your own workplace. I don't know. But, you know, you don't get on with everyone, and people have been brought up differently. But I've found in the journalism game, there was just huge, huge egos. You know, and I guess because they were pandered to. You know, when I spoke about the old Channel 9 earlier, you know, back then they could everything was laid out for them, and no expense was spared in terms of catering for the talent, the top end talent. You know, Channel 9 had a chopper, and you'd hear of some guys getting choppered home at the end of the day, or choppered to training, or choppered, you know, because it was, you know, they had the money, so they did it. So getting the back end of that, you came across people who were definitely very headstrong. I find it's about striking the right balance, because sometimes, yeah, you do, to get what you want out of these people, you do need to stroke the ego a little bit. But other times I find these people as well, if you can push back in the right manner.
Yep.
And I use Wayne Carey as the example, because he's a very charismatic guy, and he's, you know, I find a lot of his mates are sort of, yes, Wayne, yep, yes, Wayne. Whereas I reckon part of the reason that he doesn't mind me is that, you know, from the first time I went out with him, you know, I'd give him a bit of lip, and
yep.
I don't know, it's just, you do stroke the ego from time to time. It's a balance, isn't it? Like, like these people as well will write off someone if they just completely are sucking up to them. They'll wipe them as well. So I guess it's that, when you deal with people at work, when you deal with people at your footy club, you treat each person differently based on how you think their emotional response is going to be. But definitely ego-wise, sometimes you just got to sit and cop it and move on pretty quickly.
Yeah. Who would you say is the most scary, intimidating person to deal with in the media?
I mean, Clarko was for a while. I mean, I always got nervous being around Eddie initially.
Yep.
But Eddie's lovely.
Because you've got a good relationship with him now, haven't you?
I wouldn't say I'm top mates with him or anything like that, but, you know, over time you do enough things with him and he comes to respect you and what you've done. I end up working with his son, Xander, as well, and I think he's sort of appreciated different things there. But, yeah, like, because Eddie's just this larger-than-life personality, and he's, like, he's always got stuff going on. He's always got people ringing him. And so you've got to be on your toes, and you never know where the conversation's going to go with him. So, like, you're not – I don't know if it's fear, but it's there's something there that has you on edge.
You're aware that when he enters the room.
Absolutely you are. Absolutely you are. You know, even like, let's say like Caro, I after the Essendon saga, me as an Essendon person, I thought, Caro, geez, you've gone hard at the Bombers. And you have this sort of view of what she is as a person, but Caro is lovely. So it's kind of funny how the personas are very different often to what they are off the screen. But from a coach point of view, yeah, Clarko was one that you always need to keep your wits about. Damien Hardwick was one. So you're always like that, I reckon. Because these are smart guys, a lot of these people that you're dealing with, or girls, or women, sorry.
Yep.
So, yeah, the minute you relax is the minute you get yourself into trouble.
They can turn on you pretty quick.
Yeah.
What are some of the big takeaways that you've taken away from working with some of these people? Like you mentioned Eddie Maguire before. Like who would you say works the hardest in the media, and what's some of the things that you've learned from people?
Yeah, I mean, you've got to be willing to do that work. As I mentioned earlier, initially was doing those double shifts where you're getting into one at 4:45 and not getting home to after 7 or whatever, and they're big days. But Eddie and those guys and the guys at the very top, they are relentless. He was doing hot breakfast and doing it. If you want to, like, it's funny because Tony Jones is quite good mates with Eddie, and Tony rang him up and said, can you catch up for a coffee? Or Eddie might have rang him anyway. They're trying to work out a time to do a coffee, and Eddie said, you need to talk to my PA to work out. The next time he was available for, a 20-minute window was that, a week or 10 days later. You go, well, that's how structured his day is. Someone like your Tom Browns are making 100 calls a day. Craig Hutchison, like, I really admire what he's been able to do. Like, he was a journo, and now he's a media mogul in a way. He owns an empire of, he just seems to be buying new pieces of media all the time.
Owns a basketball team.
He owns a netball team now as well.
Yep.
I wouldn't be surprised if he'd get his hands on some other sporting teams if he can. So you've got to be willing to work. And I think early on, you've got to be willing to do it for when you're trying to prove yourself the nothing it might be. You know, can I come in and try out and not be paid, and you see how you go, and then if they see that you're worthwhile, then that's how you get your start. You gotta be prepared for those things, and then the payoff hopefully comes later on.
And we'll sort of jump back to jump forward now. But another thing that sort of got you into your the Truth Hurts podcast is obviously your relationship with Wayne Carey. But it started a few years ago where you started writing his column for him. Is that right? Is that how it works?
Yeah, so it is pretty funny now when I think that, you know, how often I see Wayne Carey. Like, I picked that name up off the floor. I never want to be a flog about it. But, yeah, like early doors, we had so when he first got back into the media after one of his off-field conferences, can't remember which, the first thing he did was for Nine MSN. And so there was a guy who worked for MSN at Nine, website. It was like what Wide World of Sports has become now. He wrote little columns for Carey then. And over time, he had stopped doing it for him. And then the guy that was actually doing Wayne's columns was the bloke who wrote his book. He wasn't really loving how it was going. And he had this Crown Bet column that he was doing. Just, you know, super easy. But I did it for him one day. And he said, I want you to rewrite my article that's going in the Age this week.
How does that actually work, Ed? And sorry, just to stop you, does he sort of just give you a few dot points and you make it into an article, or does he sort of pre-write something and you make it sound better, or how does it work?
Well, it's funny because he says, I reckon I could probably write these, but, you know, like, just my writing's not that good, and I think there's no way you could write, if you're on your own, there's no way you could write this. No, it's like, it's the grammar and the writing side that I do, but often it's the, you're coming up with ideas, and it's quite hard now because there's so many shows to come up with an original idea. So we would, for a column, yeah, we would chat on a, these columns used to go to print on a Friday. You had to have them written by Thursday because then they'd edit it at the Age and put in the paper. So we'd chat generally on the Wednesday. We'd chat and see what we thought. We'd maybe chat for half hour, an hour. I'd take a whole lot of notes. And then I would formulate it into an article and try and turn it into something more newsworthy. Keeping in mind, you're still trying to write it in a way that you're not using words that you don't think Wayne Carey's going to use. Because, you know, if you start using all those big words, you think, that's ridiculous. He's not saying that. But, yeah, so it's a bit of a collaboration. Then you'd talk the next day and he would say, I don't think I'd really say it like that. Maybe I want to go a bit harder here or a bit softer here. You know, you're always pushing him to go that little bit harder because you know it's going to get better coverage. But he was super aware too of his past. And so he would never want to be critical of players' behaviour necessarily, because he said, well, you know, what's the first thing they're going to say to me? They're going to say, well, you did this and you did that. And
yeah, Clarkson and was a beauty for that, wasn't it? Every time we have a crack, he'd say, we can open up on Carey.
That's the funny thing, that moment with Alistair Clarkson, he always goes on about it. He said, well, I was actually right in that circumstance. He said,
it was about Cyril, wasn't it? Yeah.
He said, Cyril Rioli wants to go back to the Tiwi. He won't stay out his contract. And Cyril had signed a 5-year deal about 6 months earlier. And Clarko ripped him a new one. And as it turned out, Cyril, I think, maybe got halfway through that deal or not even. So, yeah, he was right in that circumstance. But, yeah, so that's sort of how that happened.
Was that sort of your first foray into the print media, or were you sort of writing a bit of print media before then? Or?
No, I wasn't. I really enjoy writing. I feel like, but TV writing is very different to news writing. TV writing is very short. You have very short lines, and then you have because you want to hear from the talent. So you might get a minute 20 for your news story. And you want 30 or 40 seconds of that to be hearing from, you know, Alistair Clarkson, Kevin Sheedy, whoever. And your lines are going to be really quick and sometimes a bit quirky to write into certain pictures. Whereas in newspapers, it's very different. You can write longer. But the first column was the Muhammad Ali, Joe Frazier. He wanted to make some comparison to, you know, two teams. And I ended up rewriting his other guy's Age column, which I thought, this is going to be really awkward when you go back to him and say, I've got some other guy to rewrite this column.
Yeah.
And anyway, he submitted my column that week for the Age. He said, I think I want you to write for me. And he said, just give me a couple of weeks to just see with this guy how he can take it and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, Yeah, this is not good, because this is the bloke who wrote his book as well. So yeah. It's not like he didn't. You know, it's not some bloke off the street.
Anyway, what did he see? Sorry, I keep stopping you, but what did he see in you to give you that opportunity to rewrite it to begin with? Like, had you met him before? Or
I'd never met him. I had a half hour phone chat with him at that stage, and then he liked what I'd written for him in his Crownbet article. But I think he liked that I wrote more like he thought.
Okay. Yeah.
If that makes sense. And so he was finding he was having to redo a whole lot of his article when he got it back from this other guy, you know, go through it. He would read it and he'd say, it's just not how I talk. And so then I would send, in the first few months, send these articles back to him. He's like, I actually wouldn't change a word of it. And so I think it was just, for him, it was just, we're on the same wavelength in terms of talking about footy. And he could obviously tell I knew enough about footy that it was worthwhile. It ended up going from there. Worked columns for 5 or 6 years or maybe even longer.
Yep.
And then he's obviously left the media in certain circumstances last year. And a few people came to him and said, what do you think about the podcast? And that's how the podcast came about.
When it comes to home renovations, there's nothing more important than getting the kitchen right. So you've got two options. Have a crack at it yourself and then get someone else in to fix it, or get the team at Infinite Joinery and Designs in from the start to avoid a lot of stress and dirty looks from the better half. If you're thinking of renovating your kitchen, give Sam and the team at Infinite a call straight away. Specialising in kitchen renovations, they can also take care of new home joinery fit-outs, renovations, laundries, wardrobes. They have 3D design software, and Sam alone has over 20 years' experience in joinery and project management. Find them on Facebook and Instagram, or phone Sam on 0429 291 008, or by email, which is sam@infinitejoineryanddesign.com. So don't be like me, thinking you'll save a few bucks and have a crack at it yourself. Call these guys in so you can sit back and watch the experts go to work.
So did he handpick you to do it, or how did that collaboration come along?
Yeah, he did. Over that time of columns, like, we'd probably, I think what sort of cemented our relationship, I love a drink, as most people do, but obviously he does too. We'd gone out a few times and had a good time. So I think, you know, there was a level of trust there. We'd had a lot of conversations about, you know, pretty touchy subjects about him and his life and all that sort of thing. And obviously he felt he could trust me. You know, even though I laugh now, I go downstairs to our baby room and I've got his cot and his rocking chair from his last child in there. And I did laugh when I came home. Mum said, "Where'd you get that from?" And I said, "I won't care again. So yeah, I guess there's just that level of trust outside of the work that we did. Yeah. He knew that we bounced off each other pretty well. Definitely it's a learning experience for both of us. I'd never done much podcasting or listened to too many podcasts before that. And, you know, it takes time to find your groove as well.
Yeah.
Hopefully we're getting better all the time, hopefully tapping into a certain audience. But it's a little side project where I work out what I want to do next.
And I think the thing about it is that now that he's out of the mainstream media, you could always sense that he was a little bit reserved in what he wanted to say. And I think that, I know myself, you find it really refreshing in this day and age, somebody that will shoot from the hip and tell the truth and that. Did you have any reservations? Obviously, you've got to get back into the media. Did you have any reservations on being involved with this, and it might tarnish your brand a little bit? Or
yeah, all the time. Yeah, all the time.
Still a work in progress.
It's funny, like my mum will say, "You be careful around that Wayne Carey, all right?" Yeah. I asked a few people at the time, because when I was ghostwriting his columns, you know, no one really knew that. So it didn't really matter. There was no connotations for working with him. I don't think he'd mind me saying, like, he's aware of his past. There's some pretty bad stuff in there. I think he's a different person now. I think he's fair bit smarter, albeit that he's got himself into trouble in different ways. But I definitely asked people about what they thought, whether they thought, you know, because if he says something really controversial, sometimes you can be guilty by association. It doesn't matter that I didn't say it. I'm on the podcast with him. There are times that I have to filter him. And he's come in all guns blazing, and we're talking in the morning about what we're going to do. And he says, I want to go really hard at this. And it's a really sensitive topic, you know, might be to do with, you know, the really hot button topics, whether it's yep. transgender stuff or women's sport or whatever. And you know that if he says something really controversial,
it's going to blow up.
Yeah, like, lots of people will agree with him. And that he's like, yeah, but heaps of people will agree with me. But I go, yeah, but is the upside of saying that worth the downside? You know, I think that's what you weigh up. You want to be unfiltered. And for the most part, he is. Every now and then I'll say, oh, maybe just put that one back in the cupboard because I don't know. I don't know if that's a smart way of going about it, but you know, sometimes you've got no choice. He's like, no, I'm going to say it. I'm like, okay, well, if you're going to say it, then so be it. So yeah, it's definitely a balancing act. But at the same time, you've got realities with, you know, you want to get sponsors and all that sort of thing as well. And, you know, sponsors don't want to be involved. You know, they want something that's got a lot of listeners, but they don't want it to be really super outrageously controversial. Like they keep talking about Joe Rogan and his podcast. And I say, but Joe's so big now that he's too big to sort of fail. He can say whatever he can say whatever he wants.
Yeah.
Because he's got such a large audience. He's, you know, almost uncancelable in a way.
Mm.
Whereas, you know, we're doing this little footy podcast. It's not quite the same level.
I think it's got a fair following, mate. I think you've been pretty modest.
So anyway, it definitely was a consideration, but I'm hoping that we've struck the balance between, you know, we try and talk a bit of footy and try and talk a bit of life as well. Every, you know, I go in with certain topics. Every, my Captain Morgan cans were reduced from 375 mils to 330 mils, and you go in one day. So I'm really pissed off with this. And I'll just say, if there's any time that you've been, you know, you reckon you've been duped in your life, and then he'll come up with some supersized example of when he's been fleeced out of millions by, you know, this company. So mine's about the cans I'm drinking on the weekend. His is about some huge business deal or something like that. So
yeah. Do you sort of think it'll help you moving forward for employment opportunities where people see that someone like Wayne Carey has got that trust in you? Like, obviously, back in the day when you first met him, he knew you were working in the media, and you said that he's opened up to you about a few sort of prickly topics and things from his past, which obviously you wouldn't have divulged to anyone. Like, do you think it was a bit of a test, and do you think that is going to sort of help you moving forward, that, you know, you've got that reputation?
I think so. I think when we spoke about it before, trust is a huge thing, and people automatically, when they hear you're a reporter, sort of recoil a little bit, as if you're going to report everything they say in that very conversation, as if what they're saying is newsworthy anyway. What, mate, you're not interesting enough for me to do a bloody news story on you. But it's not like that. You're putting so many things in the back pocket that you're never going to report. But yes, I do think that because I've met a lot of people through him. When they hear that I've been doing his column for that amount of time or doing the podcast, then they think, well, if Wayne is happy enough to trust this bloke, then, and he's got a few skeletons in the closet, then probably I can be as well.
So what's the plans for the future, mate? Like, obviously you're in a bit of a gap year now, so are there any, like, big ticket ambitions that you've got, or anywhere, I don't know whether you're prepared to name them or not, but anywhere that you do want to work? Or
it's a good question. I mean, yeah, the commentary stuff over time, I thought, you know, I'd love to do that, but I've sort of, you know, since having a kid, and I've maybe reevaluated that, because I'd probably have to go through quite a few years of hard graft of really peripheral stuff that would not really pay the way that I want to be paid. To get to the top level commentators are paid really well. Even really good commentators underneath are paid on like a per game basis.
Yeah.
So it's not that easy to sustain yourself in that way. Having got a taste of that, even just with netball, I really enjoy it and I'd love to do it. But it's, I kind of think, oh, geez, I wish I'd done that when I was 25 rather than 35, with less responsibility, interest rates and a mortgage and now a kid.
And a family, yeah.
Yeah, like it hits you a bit harder at the moment when, like, I never used to, now I'm starting to think, oh, can I go and buy this or buy that. That's because I'm not working as well. When you've got money coming in, it's a bit different. So, yeah, no, commentary would, you know, I certainly haven't shut the door on it, but I like the idea of climbing the ladder at a footy club. That would probably be, you know, starting as a media manager.
Yep.
I don't want to do that forever. You know, I'd love to do more of the footy side of it. But once you've got your leg in, and I've had a lot of conversations with different footy people about this, once your leg is in the door, then you can branch off. So, that appeals to me as well. There's lots of stuff out there. It's not so much in journalism. Like I feel like I've sort of left a bit of that behind, but it's all PR, media. That, you know, there's so much crossover in those different areas that I'm sure I'll find something.
Absolutely. And your footy career's taken back off again, mate, I believe.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. yeah, look, 13 years since I last played. So I had to stop playing when I went to Channel 9 because I was working weekends. 15 kilos heavier than my playing days. Never been, as I said, particularly dynamic. So at the start of the year, I thought, well, I'm just going to dive back into it. And this might be the best lesson that anyone takes out of this podcast.
Get the pens out now, people.
That you just think, well, I'm a little bit overweight and, oh, I just need to work hard. I'll just do what I did back in the day. I'll just train 5 nights a week. And I just went down to my local footy club at Yarraville. Thought I'll just get back into it. And I played cricket down there too. So, but then I started getting, I went on this camp earlier in the year. And at the end of the camp, I couldn't hardly walk when I got back home. I kept trying to train for the next 2 weeks. I thought, you know, this might be my only shot. I don't want to miss any pre-season. In the end, I was like, I'm just too sore. I'm going to have to go get a scan. I had stress fractures on either side of my back.
Yep.
And then as our loyal True Hurts listeners would have heard last week, I was probably my fourth game back. I left pretty quickly the game, didn't cool down, sing the song or anything, rushed to the airport and got to the airport, took 2 steps. And went down like I'd been shot. I was lying on the ground for a couple of minutes. My back was, I couldn't move. I think it was 10 out of 10 pain, worst pain I've ever felt. Hobbled into the airport. I got up and hobbled into the airport, got through security, and then it happened again. And they said, oh, do you want a wheelchair?
Yeah.
I was like, oh, this is so shit. Like, this is the worst. My flight's leaving in half an hour. I'm sweating up a storm. There's people around looking at me. What's this young guy like? What's this carrying on about? But I couldn't move, and they ended up calling a paramedic for me.
Yeah.
So, look, there's been a lot of unforeseen hurdles getting back in the sport at age 35. So if you're going to do it, my physio shakes his head every time we go and he says, you've got to do it a bit more gradually. You can't do it, can't dive straight in like you've tried to do.
Yeah.
But I highly recommend it if anyone, I've loved when I've been able to get out there. I have done that. So you miss sport. I reckon sporting clubs are the greatest places for just mental health and mates and all that stuff. So awesome. Definitely missed it.
Absolutely. Now, you've told me a little bit of a fib, I believe, mate, because you said that you haven't played for about 13 years. Now, I received an email from the Bond Uni Bull Sharks who told me that you did make an ill-fated comeback up there at one stage. Are you happy to tell that story?
Yeah.
I do my research, don't worry.
Far out. Yeah, well, yes. So I had a mate, Sandwich Wilson, fellow Northwest Coaster.
Yep.
Pretty handy sports person himself on the coast. He's done great things coaching Bond University, coached them with a few flags. It was his 30th, I reckon. And we all flew up there and surprised him. We had a monster night on the Friday night, like ridiculously big and didn't get much sleep. And then went and played 2s footy the next day and, you know, hadn't played. That was one game, you know, and was unfit, and it was 28 degrees, and no sleep, no food, lots of alcohol. And, there's another – I've told all of ambulance stories. I just told one. That's embarrassing enough.
You're keeping people in jobs.
At the end of the game, I was just sitting on the bench. I got through the game okay. You know, played pretty poorly. The game was broadcast, actually, and one of the blokes back at work recorded it and did a low lights reel, which was kind of him. But my whole body, like, kind of shut down, and my arms and legs just kind of clenched up, and I couldn't move them. I couldn't move any of my muscles. It wasn't painful. I just couldn't move. And I thought, am I having a heart attack or something? So they ended up calling the ambulance for me that day too. So yes, there was one game in those 13 years that I played. And yes, it also ended in an ambulance. I'm definitely taking out far too many resources.
Well, at least, mate, like we talked about your persistence and pushing through, and obviously that's helped you in your footy career as well, because something like that didn't frighten you off. You still made a comeback later on in life anyway, so I'm sure it won't happen again.
Well, I hope not.
Mate, just last question for you. What would be your main piece of advice for anyone who wanted to get into the media? So if anyone's, you know, listening, anyone at, you know, your old school, Reece High School, Don College, that, you know, want to get into the media, what one piece of advice would you give them?
I think always, like, just shoot for the stars in terms of what you have. It's really cliche, Mark, and say a bit better. But I reckon you never know if you don't ask the question.
Yep.
And I always talked about this to, you know, other people we had come in the newsroom who were younger. And often I feel like it's almost in a footy analogy. You keep putting yourself in the right position. It might not happen for you the first 10 times or the first 20 times or whatever, but if you keep putting yourself in the right position, then eventually it'll come off for you. And I, to you, when I, how do I portray that in a news sense or a journalism sense, you know, you keep going for it. And if you've done the work, or if you're putting in the work, it might not happen for you initially, but like I took that bit of advice from, so it's funny, had these bits of advice come to you from different people in unexpected circumstances. He said it a bit differently to me, but it was Drew Morfitt, the late Drew Morfitt, who was a footy commentator. The first time I'd done a bit of boundary, and I came in and told him a bit about myself, and he sort of said, you know, you never know, sometimes you might be plugging away thinking nothing's going to open up for you, doing the same thing for 5 years or whatever. But, that, you know, always keep your wits about you, your body language upbeat, and, you know, and you never know who might notice you, and things can just change in an instant. Someone will fall over, or and I think that's it. Just keep having a crack. Be really mindful of the impression that you're giving off. I'm big on first impressions and body language and all that sort of stuff. I often fall into the trap of judging people the first time I meet them, which I shouldn't do all the time. But I think that's a really natural thing to do, that we do as humans. So keep that in mind whenever you're out and about, that you never know who might be watching.
That's pretty much all I've got for you. But you know, I really appreciate you coming on, taking the time to come on a fellow podcast. We're not going to be rivaling you in the ratings, I know that's for sure. But you know, congratulations on what you guys are doing. Like I said, I'm really enjoying the podcast. And to anyone who's listening to this that hasn't jumped on the Truth Hurts podcast, I'd highly recommend it. You know, if you're sick of this world where people have to filter and water stuff down, you know, it's just refreshing to hear people shoot from the hip and tell the truth. Now, again, whether you're a Wayne Carey lover or not. So, you know, the main things that I get out of your story, mate, are your perseverance. And I think that it is going to inspire a lot of people, particularly in this area. Like I said, you know, that a young fella that went to Reece High School can end up, you know, doing a podcast with, you know, the best footballer that that I've ever seen. So with your perseverance, mate, I'm sure we're going to see you on the screens commentating at some stage, or we might even see it at the head running a footy club.
Well, thanks, Brent. I really appreciate the time. It's funny you're saying all that stuff. Like you don't think you'll ever think your life's that remarkable, or people that can take anything out of it. But having, you know, listened now to a couple that you had, like Nick Haywood and those guys on there, like, sometimes it's just one thing you take, isn't it? So I really appreciate you giving me the time and having me on.
No worries at all.
I loved having a chat with Ayrton, and as a sports nuffy myself, I could have talked to him all day. There's plenty of great stories there. Key takeaways from our chat that I found were, if you have a goal, keep putting yourself in the right positions for success.
Don't be discouraged if it doesn't come about straight away, and stay ready, as you never know when a twist of fate might give you the opportunity you've been looking for. Stand your ground, and if something doesn't sit well with you or compromises your morals, stay true to yourself, even if it's in a work sense, as our values and self-respect are far more important. Never underestimate the power and value of putting time into building relationships with people, particularly in a work sense dealing with so many different personalities, but also in daily life. Life's so much easier if we can all establish a little bit of common ground, and you never know, you might just learn something from that person. Lastly, if you've got a dream and you get a little opportunity, work your backside off to make it a reality. The result will almost certainly be worth it. Thanks for listening, and if anyone has any other great guests we can follow up, don't be afraid to hit us up on socials. We'd love to hear from you. As Northwest Tassie is a remote area, I just want to quickly tell you about a great organisation doing their bit to help the rural community deal with mental health and suicide. Rural Alive and Well, or better known as RAW, R-A-W, have a mission to build healthy and resilient rural and remote communities to reduce the prevalence of suicide. RAW specialises in providing a proactive outreach and one-on-one support service, which addresses situational stresses and increases protective factors to minimise the risk of suicide. RAW is non-clinical, genuine and non-intrusive. The service is confidential with no fees for participants, and it uses a person-centred shared goals approach. RAW adopts a culturally sensitive, strength-based and collaborative approach to delivering services. Their team come from a range of backgrounds and receive training and ongoing support to provide evidence-informed care to people. To access their services, call 1800 729 827. You can find them on Facebook and Instagram, or jump on their website www.rawtas.com.au.